Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 12, 2025, and our friends John Helmer and Ray McDowell are back. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's get started with the first round of negotiations between the United States and Ukrainians, in which what was so surprising that there is no Keith Kellogg participating in the talks. And here is what Marco Rubio said. And if you look at the tweets that they put on X, you see they're all saying that the ball is now on Russia's court. It's talking about the 30-day ceasefire that the United States is the outcome of the first round of negotiations. We don't know what are the details of these negotiations. By the way, hearing what Marco Rubio said in terms of Russia rejecting this proposal on the part of the United States.
Time, have you had any contact with them? What's been their response officially, and are they willing to accept the ceasefire unconditionally?
Well, I mean, we don't know the answer to the last question. That's what we want to know, whether they're prepared to do it unconditionally. We'll have contact with them today. There's already been contacts at different levels with counterparts, different members of the administration, and that'll continue. But as far as the Russian reaction to it, that's really the question here. And that is, you know, this is a few hours old. We're going to bring it to them directly. We're going to say that Ukraine is prepared to stop all battlefield activity and begin the immediate process of negotiating an enduring end to the war. And we'll see what their response is. If their response is yes, then we know we've made real progress and there's a real chance of peace. If their response is no, it would be highly unfortunate and it would make their intentions clear. So that's what we're hoping to hear from them. And obviously, as I said, that this was not prearranged for them. So they're probably processing the news the same as the rest of the world is. So we hope to have a positive answer from them. The ball is truly in their court.
By the way, what we've learned from Peskov, he said that they don't know the details of the negotiations. That's why they don't want to comment on the ceasefire. They need to learn it. They need to study the way that the Trump administration is trying to picture for Russia. By the way, and putting all that aside, how did you find the proposal? If the proposal is 30-day ceasefire, is that going to attract Russia?
Well, go ahead. Yeah. Well, let's start with the Russian side. In first place, Mr. Peskov is giving a lesson of how you deal with negotiations to Mr. Rubio. The first thing you do is you say that when two sides are at war and you're attempting to mediate them, you say, well, the other side has given us our proposals and we're going to take them home and consider them and we will pass them to the other side and we will try to see how the two proposals come together, what the degrees of differences are, and so forth and so on. But Rubio didn't say that. In the first place, what Rubio said, every 15 seconds, I looked at I measured it on the video, and then you look at the transcript. Every 15 seconds, Marco Rubio said, Trump or the president. In other words, the Secretary of State, and I've never seen this before, kept using an echo chamber effect in order to say that what he was saying there was what President Trump told him to say. And that's more important in a sense for Rubio, making public what happened, than what the Ukrainians had proposed. That's the first point. The second point was that Rubio and Waltz clearly endorsed the Ukrainian position, as did President Trump later on in the day, endorsed it. They're not attempting to say, we're going to consider it, and we'll ask the Russians to consider it. The US took the Ukrainian position, and they didn't just take with an echo effect, President Trump's the president of peace and that sort of thing. They took the Ukrainian side, and they, if you look at the joint statement, it refers to a line that only comes in Ukrainian propaganda that happens to be false. And that's the reference to what's said in the joint statement as, quotes, forcibly deported Ukrainian children to Russia. Now, there was no reason for that line to be in it, in the joint statement. It was a propaganda statement. It's false. It's been rejected many times over by the Russian side. But the fact that it's there indicates that either Walz and Rubio were making a mistake, or they weren't making a mistake. They were deliberately endorsing a Ukrainian propaganda operation. And then what obviously happens is echo effect plus propaganda. The US is now supporting a Ukrainian operation, PR operation, to make the Russian side look bad. That's what's happening. And that is so obvious to the Russian side and was anticipated by the Russian side. The only people who've been fooled by the notion that it would be anything less are people who think President Trump wants peace, not war. And then you have what I might call, say, you're there in the United States and you know it better. I call this the Monica Lewinsky effect. The United States sits at his desk and says things publicly, while under the desk, everybody around him satisfies his ego. And that's obvious in the way in which Europeans, President Macron of France, Prime Minister Starmer of the UK, the European Union, boss Ms. von der Leyen, and not to mention all the other US officials, all cater to the president as the president of peace. This is the Monica Lewinsky effect. It doesn't convince anyone in Moscow. And then two other points, or very short points. If you want to get a reality measurement, you look at the way money is talking. Money talks more sensibly because the risk is immediate and greater of losing your money. The Moscow stock market is up approximately, I haven't got the numbers right, and since December, the Moscow stock is up 30%, 33%. But over the past day, in responding to the Jeddah talks, it dropped 0.46%, 0.46%. The only significant loser on the Moscow stock market over the past 12 hours has been Oleg Deripaska's EN Plus group, which is attached to aluminium. Deripaska has been floating up coordination with the United States, and the market thinks that's not going to fly. But the Moscow market reaction, very restrained, a little disappointed, but not at all in the belief that there's going to be a kind of deal which makes business come back to usual. But you look at the S&P index, 10% down in the last few days. Overall, since December, my chart here says is 8.4% down. And then you look at the Trump stocks. That's the way the money looks at President Trump's credibility. That's not the Monica Lewinsky effect. That's what politicians do. The money effect is Tesla is down 49% since December. Peter Thiel's Palantir down 30%. And then the acid test, Donald Trump Jr.'s company, Trump Media and Technology Group. You know what? It's down 67% since December. Now, what does that tell you? Money doesn't believe that the president, when the president of peace is a president of peace. They think he's a president of war, and they think that's bad for business.
Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, Nima, actually, I take a little contrarian view here. I think, John, that peace is bad for business. I think you can trace the cause and effect here to the fact that it looks like peace might be breaking out. That's really bad, especially for the arms makers and the arms traders. That's why things are down in the United States. And that is precisely why things are up in Europe. My God, well, those people in Europe are making a bundle of money, the arms control people. let's get back to Trump. You know, he's totally unpredictable. We know that this fellow General Kellogg was not to be believed by the things that he said. Chalk it up to naivete, or just not getting the message, or listening to the wrong people in Washington, not listening to Trump personally. Now, Rubio is a similar kind of novice. He's an amateur. I can't account for the fact that he seems to have bought into this Ukrainian propaganda, but it really doesn't matter much in my view. What matters is what Trump wants to do, okay? And what Trump wants to do is end this damn thing, in my view. In other words, I think he and Putin share a common aim in putting this thing behind them for lots of reasons, lots of good reasons. The history is sordid. It's worse than Monica Lewinsky. Betrayal after betrayal, which Lavrov made clear in his two-hour conversation with my friends Judge Napolitano and Larry Johnson just a couple of days ago. So it all depends on how Trump's going to proceed here. Will he trim his tails because of misstatements by Marco Rubio? I don't think so. Will he say, oh yeah, maybe ceasefire is a good idea before we finish off the Ukrainians? I don't think so. What Lavrov was asked during this extended interview was, how about that June 2024 statement that you, Lavrov, made before the Russian Foreign Ministry? Are those terms still in effect? And the answer, of course, was, of course they are. No Ukraine and NATO, blah, blah, blah. The whole thing right down the line. Now, is Putin going to say, oh, Rubio has worked out the deal with the Ukrainians? All right, so I changed my mind? No way is that going to happen. So this thing's going to continue. I'm with you on that. This thing's going to continue, but largely because the arms suppliers and the arms makers in Europe, and it'll catch up with the U.S., will have a bonanza if this thing continues up to the last Ukrainian. And let's not blanch before the fact that that's what this thing is all about. Up to the last Ukrainian, well, that means as long as it takes. And I, you know, to watch these young people, Ukrainians and Russians, kill each other off to the last person there in Ukraine is a sad spectacle. And I do think that Trump wants to end it. And we'll just to have to see how he works things out personally with Putin. That's where the game is being played. Rubio and Kellogg, well, forget about it. And Mike Waltz as well. They're useful people to divert attention to the real game. Let's see what Trump says now.
John, here is what Marco Rubio, it seems that security guarantee is one of the main concerns about Ukraine. Here is what Marco Rubio said to the press.
Just something that there has been some reluctance for the administration to elaborate on. Are you committing to security guarantees?
Well, I think the point to understand is that we're looking at is securing their long-term, what we want to see, like any country in the world, Ukraine wants their long-term security. They want to make sure that this doesn't happen again. We all do. I mean, what is the point of spending all this time to get a ceasefire, hopefully, and then a negotiated end of the war, only to see it re-spark up again in about 6 years, 4 years, 3 years? We're not interested in that, and they certainly aren't either. So I think the question really is more about a deterrence. Can Ukraine create a sufficient deterrent against future aggression, against future attack, against future invasion? Because every country in the world has a right to defend themselves, and no one can dispute that. So that will most certainly have to be part of the conversation. But again, I don't think there isn't a peace to secure until you have a peace. But there's no way to have an enduring peace without the deterrence piece being a part of it.
Can I just follow up on that?
This is nonsense. This is rubbish. And if this confirms every suspicion on the Russian side that Russia has to negotiate this war with its real source, and that's the United States. And second, the United States is not negotiating. I'm not saying the United States. Let's say the Trump administration, and let's not bother with what Ray and I have been critical of the Biden administration. That's gone and dead. Let's just focus on what that meant. And what that means is, take a look at what he said. Ukraine has got to have security guarantees from Russia so that Ukraine won't be subject to another attack. This is absolutely back to front. It is exactly what Rubio and the war fighters that Trump has put into power since January 20 think, and it motivates their operation. Number one, what has to happen at the Putin level is there will be no disrespect, no joking, no Monica Lewinsky jokes about President Trump personally. It is not in Russia's interest to insult the president or to take any of the lines that the Democratic National Committee and Democratic Party have taken against Trump. One can count on the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or well, maybe not the Wall Street Journal, but the Washington Post to do all that sort of insult. No, no, that's not what President Putin is going to say if there's a telephone call, and it's far from certain there will be. Second, as to the ceasefire, that's not to the benefit of Russia. Russia has in the past several days accelerated its offensive westward. The Kursk operation, this has been celebrated all over Russia. And if Trump lacks Russia experts to read the Russian press for him, or there are some very good pictures of an extraordinary operation in which a group of Russian Spetsnaz, special forces, taking journalists with them through a pipe 15 kilometers, get into the center of Sudja and plant the Russian flag as they expand out and destroy the Russian occupation of Sudja. And that's the beginning of the end of the Kursk operation as the Ukrainians try to run away. Now, Kursk will be emptied of Ukrainians very shortly. Second, the Russian side is making sure that the Sumy region of Ukraine will be neutralized, demilitarized, will not be able to be reoccupied for another attack on Russia. And that's much more important now everywhere. You don't have to read a Russian newspaper to understand. Every Russian understands that will not happen again. And that means a demilitarized buffer zone in Sumy. Sumy is not part of the June 2024 terms of end of war, which President Putin delivered at the foreign ministry, as Ray's referred to. So on the line going southwards, the casualty rate this past day has been close to 1,200. We've said on this program, Nima, pointing out that the rate of casualties, whatever the exact numbers may be, the Ukrainian casualty rate's roughly 50% more than it was in February. That means the Russian side is moving westward, taking more and more territory and pushing the Ukrainians out of the four regions, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Donetsk, and Lugansk. There's still quite a way to go territorially and quite a way to fight. And as we said, I think on this program, the Russian general staff will not be attacking cities. They will not fight for Pokrovsk. They'll go round and create a cauldron. If the Ukrainians want to run away, they might be allowed out or they'll be killed. But there will be no Mariupol battle, no Bakhmut battle for cities within the four regions. You've seen in the last few days very considerable new attacks on Odessa with the attempt to stop Ukrainian and British forces using Odessa as a base to intensify their Black Sea war. That's basically a British operation supported by US and British aircraft over the Black Sea. You've also seen increasing infrastructure attacks to cut the gas off in east of the Dnieper River as well as west of the Dnieper River. So at this point, from a Russian point of view, there are a ceasefire is simply a PR device to relieve the pressure on the Ukrainians as they retreat. It's to protect the Ukrainian front from collapsing. It's to protect the Kiev regime from having to sign articles of capitulation. And when, in that very interesting clip that you provided of Mr. Rubio, when the US speaks of security guarantees for the Ukraine, the Russians read only one message. What Rubio is offering is another form of save the Ukraine, buy them time, the same formula that Hollande and Merkel and the US all thought Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 would do. No, this is not the moment for Russian credibility for Rubio or President Trump, who said in the clip I've seen a few hours ago that if the Russians say no, the war will go on. Well, that's to kind of state the obvious. But what I can imagine first is there might be a telephone call. There will be nothing but respect from President Putin to President Trump. And it's even conceivable that President Putin might, it's not my opinion, sources' opinion, might offer an Easter ceasefire. Now, why would the Russian side even contemplate an Easter ceasefire? And the answer is because they've offered it before, attached to the first time in many, many years that the Orthodox Church Easter coincides with the Catholic Church Easter on April the 20th. April the 20th. Between April the 20th and May the 9th, when Russia will celebrate the 80th anniversary of destroying the German form of attack on Russia, it's a possible goodwill gesture. But just bear in mind the Russian experience of this. Our side, and I speak as a Russia correspondent, so Russia's our, we, and my sources all remember that when President Putin offered a Christian Christmas ceasefire at Christmas 2022, Zelensky rejected it dismissively. So a ceasefire attack attached to a Russian and religious function is conceivable if one's playing PR. But one's not playing PR, as Ray said. Well, this is a war. And what Mr. Rubio said is a statement of one side of the war. And if and when Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Waltz and some others show up in Moscow, if and when they do, they will be obliged to understand that if they're there to represent the Ukraine, that's a one-sided negotiation. And as Ray said, it'll be done at the presidential level, respectfully. At the lower level, it'll be done categorically.
Yeah, I would say, Dima, that it's a cart before the horse problem. Here, Rubio naively is saying, well, we have to have some sort of security guarantees for the Ukrainians. Well, that's the cart. The horse is security guarantees for Russia. That's what this whole thing is all about, okay? And Putin, in his next conversation with Trump, will say, now, remember what I told you before? I mean, this whole thing has got to be broadened out to a new architecture, which corresponds with agreements going back decades, saying, look, no country is entitled to build up their forces to the point where they have a unilateral advantage of another country in Europe. Okay, so they'll get back to reality. With respect to the details, Peskov, you know, the presidential spokesman for Putin, he said, well, you know, the devil's in the details. We don't have any details. All we have is Rubio saying these things. Let's see the details. Well, that's an eminently sensible approach to take. And when the details come out, well, then the Russians will have to deal with them and deal with them in their own way. With respect to the battlefront, the Russians are winning, for God's sake. Are the Russians in any hurry? No, the Russians aren't in any hurry. Can they take back all of Donetsk now? They have all of Lugansk. Yes, they can. Do they need to do it tomorrow? No. Next month? No. They can wait. This is not about taking back territory. It's about destroying the Ukrainian army, for God's sake. That's what demilitarization means, okay? So Putin is in the catbird seat. And Trump is smart enough to realize that. So when these two talk and they get over this business of things that people, neophytes like Rubio and before him General Kellogg say, this is going to be the makings of a deal. It's just going to take a little longer. And, you know, Trump realizes that Putin has all the high cards. Putin has four aces, okay? Ukraine has a pair of deuces. I mean, it's that simple. And Trump understands that. He told Zelensky, you have no cards. You have to have cards to play this game. So I think we need to be patient. I think Rubio and Kellogg have to be seen for the chinovniks, the bureaucrats that they are. Rubio being a senator from Florida, for God's sake, what does he know about Ukraine? And Kellogg being a failed national security advisor for Trump the first time. So pay no attention to these folks. Take a look at what happens now. Take a look at how fast the Russians are going to not go ahead on land, but obliterate the rest of the Ukrainian power structure and other things which they can and will do. And recently I already saw that someone in Russia is threatening, well, maybe we ought to use some more Oreshniks. I think that came out of the Duma, the parliament there in Russia. A couple more Oreshniks should give them pause. And I dare say that's possible. And that would give everyone pause because of the terrible, terrible might of these Oreshniks and the fact that they cannot be defended against.
John, when the way that Ray is talking about the security guarantee, not to Ukraine, but to Russia, it's mm-hmm. all about the NATO movement to the borders of Russia. And how about the security guarantee to Ukraine, to both Russia and Ukraine, would be Ukraine as a buffer zone, as we were talking about it, and a neutralized Ukraine forever and on the Russian border. That would be hugely beneficial for all the parties, don't you think?
Well, from a Russian point of view, yes, it would be. The security architecture that surrounds that for Europe was spelled out by Mr. Lavrov's ministry December 17, 2021. And we've spoken of this on the program before. And the audience can go back and look at the two treaties that were offered by Russia to the United States and to NATO, essentially rolling back NATO's capacity to destroy Russia with nuclear weapons to the NATO borders of 1997. Doesn't mean roll back NATO to 1997. That would leave Poland terribly undefended, and Radek Sikorski would go ballistic about that. On the other hand, as we've said before, and as President Putin has said many times, in the crosshairs of Russia's long-term security, the security guarantee for Russia, the nuclear capability to attack Russia at Deveselu in southern Romania, at the U.S. Aegis base in southern Romania, and Rzeczykovo, the Aegis base in northern Poland, could be shuttered. That means closed. That means the warheads removed. Now, that would be a significant signal of Trump's willingness to come to the broader European picture. Of course, what we hear from the Europeans is different. Mr. Tusk, the Polish Prime Minister, has spoken of having Trump redeploy troops from Germany into Poland, bigger tripwire, and add nuclear weapons as if they're not already there in storage around Rzeczykovo. Poland points at two enemies, Russia and Germany, and the half of Poland is split as to which is the worse enemy. But Poland is an indicator, a weather vane, if you like, of the European reluctance to any form of security guarantee along the 2021 treaty lines. What we've seen with Starmer and Macron, what I call the Monica Lewinsky effect for Trump, is to endorse what this sort of president of peace has just tried to do in Jeddah, and make it look as if it conforms with what they understood Trump to have been saying a couple of weeks back. Their idea is a peacekeeping force that's a war-making force, a force that would put in NATO troops, as once NATO was considering doing following the MH17 crash in July 2014. At that time, the Germans vetoed that operation. The Dutch were all in favor of it. I think we've said on this program before that a peacekeeping force would be to be pointed westward on the western line of the DMZ. Russia's more than capable of ensuring a demilitarized zone between the four regions Ray and I've just mentioned, and Kiev and then Lvov. Okay, a DMZ, which will now include, over the last few hours, I've seen very clear signs from my sources that the general staff clearly identify Sumy region and possibly Chernigov region. We're getting extremely close now to Kiev as part of the demilitarized zone. Okay. Second, if there were to be a peacekeeper force, it must point westward to stop the Ukrainians breaking out a kind of anti-Idlib solution, so that there can't be a breakout that would come back at Russia. And Russia can enforce that and protect the DMZ without the intervention of hostile forces, hence the repeated warnings that no peacekeeping force that flies flags that have been flown in Kursk against Russia, on the line against Russia, those will not be acceptable, neither French nor British nor Polish, whatever. So if the devil's in the details, one thing that has to be done, and we agree, Ray and I, is the US side has to read the details, and it's not very difficult. The Russian side has been very clear on what the details are on maps. Second, the general staff has been very clear on how to get there, and I entirely agree with Ray. And I tried to explain this the other day. The Russian side's not interested in Trump's carrots. They're quite capable of defending themselves against Trump's sticks. The Russian weapon is the clock. Russia isn't in a hurry, just as Ray said. The clock is ticking toward the capitulation of the Ukraine. Capitulation, that means replacement of Zelensky, a new regime, and a curtailment to the extent possible of the kind of neo-Nazi, neo-fascist, Russia-hating, race-hating war fighters whose grandparents, whose entire generation since Hitler emboldened them in the 1940s, is to fight and kill Slavs. They have to be bottled, and that can be done between Kiev and Lvov without the kinds of weapons, long-range weapons, that attack Russia.
No, I would endorse what you just said, John. You know, when people think DMZ, they think more Korea. Well, no, that's not the kind of DMZ we're talking about here. Lavrov said 2 years ago, look, it's a matter of geography. It's a matter of how long the range of your weapons is. That's how long this cordon sanitaire has to be. All right, you got that, guys? That's how big it's got to be, okay? Now, that's clear. It makes good sense. And of course, Trump himself has acknowledged. He has said explicitly, you know, I can understand why Putin wouldn't want a heavily armed NATO member on his border in the form of Ukraine. I can understand that. That's 80% of the problem, folks. 80% of the problem. Now, what else? I would just say that that I watched two of my colleagues, Judge Napolitano and Larry Johnson, interview Lavrov. It was 2 days ago, but it just went up. It is idiosyncratic. It is unprecedented in my experience. And I think I go back even longer than John does, okay, watching these things, all right? Lavrov is incredibly relaxed, okay? He's discursive. He rehearses the whole history. He answers questions. He comes across as so self-confident, even in English, that he's never at a loss for words. Now, that's big, okay? That was 2 hours. What else? Well, he sort of not only disparaging of Western leaders, which is something new, you know, he talks about Führer von der Leyen, you know, Ursula von der Leyen, he calls her the Führer. He could say Führerin, okay? You know what Führer means, right? He talks about her in a very disdainful way. And what else? Whoa, he talks about Marco, the various lies that Macron has said. Lies. Diplomats don't usually say Macron lies, but of course he does. And Lavrov is calling him out on it. Now, he also says, and this is the kicker here for me and for John, I believe, he said, oh yeah, Macron now is going to defend all of Europe, right? Right, where there's three bombs. Okay, now, what does that mean? Well, it's bizarre on the face of it. What does it also mean? As John has pointed out many times, Putin has to look at his admirals and his generals looking over his shoulder, okay? And they could say, look, you can left Vladimir, but it would just take one of those three bombs to ruin your whole day, okay? So this is serious. We need to talk sense into not only Trump, but the likes of Macron. They are loose cannons. We don't pretend to understand what they're doing, but we are your military advisors. Watch out, because this sense of this new sense of being very, very cool that Lavrov exudes, that could be trouble. You know why? Because they betrayed us before. And they're going to betray us again unless you get hard-nosed guarantees. That's what Putin has to deal with. One extra thing here. John mentioned the treaties, the treaty that the Russians broached to NATO and to the U.S. In December, mid-December of 2021. Now, what most people don't know is that when Putin addressed his general staff, his all his admirals and generals, on the 21st of December, 2021, he said, look, this is really trouble. There are not only those missiles in Poland and Ukraine, but, you know, they could put them in Ukraine. They could put them in Poland and Romania, but they put them in Ukraine, Mr. And Putin said, you're right. When they get hypersonic missiles, they will put them in Ukraine, and that will give me 4 to 5 minutes, 4 to 5 minutes to react or to decide whether to blow up the rest of the world. He didn't say it that way. That's what it got. So what happened? That was the 21st of December. I believe, and John would be a better authority on this because he knows the general staff, I believe that those admirals and generals went to Vladimir Vladimirovich and said, look, you talk about another piece of paper, you know, wasn't the ABM treaty written down and the INF treaty and the open sky? Look, you get a personal commitment from the President of the United States. Well, that would be better than treaties. What happens? The Kremlin calls the White House on the 30th of December, 2021 and says, Mr. Putin would like to talk to Mr. Biden right away, please, right away. What's going on here? Our delegations are meeting in Geneva in just 10 days. What's the big, please, Mr. Putin would really like to talk to Mr. Biden. Now, Biden was in Delaware. He didn't have any of his cockamamie associates with him, okay? He takes the call, to his credit. And what Putin extracts from him is a promise. The readout of this thing says, Mr. Biden said that the United States has no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, period, end quote. It's in the readout, okay? Ushakov, the big advisor to Putin, is ecstatic. New Year's Eve has never been so joyous in Russian. He said, oh, this is real, because that commitment fully answers four of the seven precepts or overtures in the treaty that they gave to NATO and to us. So it was all going, and what happens? Well, the people who convene in Geneva, our delegation headed by Wendy Sherman, Ryabkov, the head of the Russian delegation, says, well, okay, let's get the brass tacks now. Let's figure out how we figure out not to put medium strike missiles or intermediate range missiles in Ukraine. And she says, what's that about? He says, about what the president said to Putin. She said, I have no instructions on that. I don't. And Lavrov himself talks to Blinken, who happens to be wandering through Geneva on the 21st of January, 2022 now, okay, a month later. And he says, hey, Tony, what about what your president said on the 30th of December to my president? And what does Blinken say? Forget about it. We weren't there with him. Jake Sullivan and I were returning Christmas presents, for God's sake. You know, he was home alone, so to speak, okay? Forget about it. We have the right to put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, and we will do so if the Ukrainians ask us. Now, well, we might be able to talk about limiting the numbers of them. So Lavrov wires back to Moscow. These people are treacherous. They don't accord with their promises. Forget about it. Next thing you know, Putin goes to Beijing, gets Big Brother to acquiesce in a violation of Westphalia. By all he said to Putin, okay, if you have to do this, please, you're going to do it after the Winter Olympics are over, right, lad? Like, oh, of course. You know what happened? They ended on the 20th of February. 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 24th was the invasion. That's part of history. So what I'm saying here is there's a deep, deep distrust here that's got to be overcome. And those admirals and those generals about which John talked so eloquently are a big player here, because they're not going to let Putin take liberties, or even Lavrov, seem very comfortable with U.S. assurances.
John, I
agree. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We have a video of Vladimir Putin in June 2024. He was mentioning having ceasefire with Ukraine, in which he mentioned two preconditions. One of them was the withdrawal of Ukrainian forces from Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporozhye, and Kherson. The second one was that an official declaration on the part of Ukrainian that they're not going to seek in for NATO membership.
Mm-hmm.
These are two preconditions. Do you think that those preconditions continue to be the same, or Russia is just reconsidering those preconditions?
No. They're different. And Mr. Lavrov has said it, President Putin has said it. What our conditions were then always included a qualifier in relation to the conditions on the ground. And that was then. The ground's different now. The conditions on the ground are different. There are fewer Ukrainians. But on the ground, we have to take into account some of the other things that President Trump has talked about. For example, in the address to the joint session of Congress, he spoke of what he called the Golden Dome. President Trump can also speak of the gold card that will allow Russian oligarchs to emigrate to the United States, And this one's the Golden Dome, which is a variation of the Iron Dome, which the Iranian hypersonics have already demonstrably shown can be penetrated. But President Trump offered the notion that he believes the United States can have a kind of Reagan-era protection from mutual assured destruction, from the capability of the nuclear adversary to strike back were the U.S. to implement a first strike. And President Putin, President Trump has also indicated a strong belief and commitment to the development of U.S. hypersonic weapons, which would then be first strike capable against Russia. So you combine a Trump belief in U.S. hypersonics, a U.S. Oreshnik, for example, plus a Golden Dome protection, which Trump believes in. Let's leave aside the question of whether any of these things have been feasible, whether any of the evidence on the table shows they're feasible. Can somebody like Trump be persuaded, as in a sense Reagan was persuaded, that some of these Star Wars type fabrications, while good for the arms makers, as Ray has pointed out, are in fact fictions, cartoon fictions, in planning nuclear strategy? If Trump is concerned, believes in that sort of U.S. supremacy, U.S. superiority, and the weapons, both offensive and defensive, to protect, then Russia has to say Trump is no different from and no less treacherous than his predecessor. And one can remember the way in which Putin sat patiently when Obama was insulting him in public. One remembers how Putin was not insulted so much by President Clinton, but betrayed by Clinton's wife. And it just goes on and on. There's President Putin is the most receptive to Ray's position that a commitment person to person from a president is something the US side will keep. The general staff, who've been telling President Putin since 2014, "We told you so." That means we told you that wouldn't happen, but it did. Now you ask us to clean up your mistake. I'm simplifying. There might have been some expletives used. This is a problem for now. As Ray said, is there a basis for anyone on the Russian side, President Putin, Yuri Ushakov, Sergei Lavrov, or General Gerasimov, to believe anything President Trump tells Putin on the telephone or person to person? Answer is, there's no basis for that level of trust. There would have to be a considerable demonstration of goodwill on both sides. And goodwill means pull back things that are bad, that can attack you. And frankly, on the one hand, there's a factional view in Moscow that Russia needs more time to rebuild its army, more time to recover from the damage done of the past since 2014. And that time should be spent with whatever optimization of Trump conditions Trump can bring to the table, or send his men to bring to the table. On the other hand, security guarantees, trust but verify, the Reagan slogan applied to the United States, that rule requires that Trump's offers can be enforced. Now, a man who hits Canada with a threat of invasion and a 50% tariff against Canadian aluminium and then withdraws them, he hasn't withdrawn the invasion of Canada yet, but he has withdrawn the tariff or postponed it. That level of changeability and unpredictability creates what the general staff and my sources call the observer effect. The observer effect is the closer you look at these objects, targets, people, the more you interpret in relation to them, and the closer you get, the more unpredictable they become under your observation. Observation isn't a form of verification. That's what we do. We are observers. But the closer we get, in my view, the foggier the target is. A military officer with a responsibility to secure his country is a little different, as Ray said, from a politician. And his job is to protect against the worst possibility. And the general staff have been telling the Kremlin, we told you so, you were mistaken, over and over again, including the regrettable battle for Antonov Airport that was fought in the first week of the special military operation, the first week of March 2022. The danger for a politician is to be understood as making repeated mistakes that cost lives and cost votes. And at this point, the problem for President Putin is listening to all the factions. He cannot blunt the offensive now. Second, he cannot be disrespectful or insulting towards the President of the United States. Everybody in the United States can be, but not President Putin, okay? And nor should we, actually. But the terms under which there can be a serious negotiation have yet to be even tabled by the US side. Now, I don't think Mr. Witkoff comes to Moscow to table terms. He's a developer, a speculator. He's there to talk about US money and Russian money, represented by Kirill Dmitriev, the special Kremlin negotiator for economic development with possible friends. Money to money talks they can have. They can spring different people out of different jails on either side. But Witkoff cannot discuss the military issues, and there isn't a military working group appointed by the US side to talk to the Russian side yet, nor is there a working group which has diplomats capable of discussing the military issues yet. When there is, we know that both sides will be serious. Russia's ready, as Ray said, since 2021, to put those details on the table. Sherman and Blinken dismissed them arrogantly, and that made inevitable the road to war that began on February 24, a few weeks later. But the Trump side does not yet show a capability to talk military maps. It only talks talk.
Go ahead, yeah. Wayne.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I'd pick up on that. And I'd just say, it's going to take an awful lot of effort to rebuild trust. Now, you may recall, John, that back in September of 2013, Putin wrote an op-ed in the New York Times praising Obama and his successful efforts to avoid war in Syria. And how'd they do that? The Russians persuaded the Syrians to destroy all their chemical weapons, and they did, under UN supervision. And so here's this op-ed where Putin is saying, my God, I really relish the trust that has grown, not only between our two countries, but between President Obama and myself, okay? What happened? Well, the neocons came in and said, trust, my God, forget about it. 6 months later, the revolution or the coup on the Maidan in Kiev after $5 billion with a B dollars have been invested in that. Witness what Victoria Nuland said, trust evaporated. So we had an ACME and now we have a Nader, which keeps going down. What's the only solution here? Well, one thing that I would simply mention that hasn't been mentioned ever recently is that when Medvedev, Dmitry Medvedev, was president of Russia, he was at a G20 in Seoul, North Korea, and Obama was running for re-election. And Medvedev was saying to Obama, and we know that because the ABC microphone was still live, he says, look, we're really worried about these so-called anti-ballistic missiles you're putting in Central Europe. We need to do something about that, okay? What do you say? And Obama says, oh, well, sure. Just wait until after I get reelected and we'll deal with that. No problem. And Medvedev, I think he regrets it now, but he's caught saying, oh, yes, well, I'll tell Vladimir that. Oh, sure, I'll tell Vladimir. Well, that was just one betrayal that hasn't been mentioned much. But that's perhaps why Medvedev hates hates the U.S. in a way that most other people are unwilling to say. So how about this Iron
Dumb.
Dumb, yeah. Oh, I was just going to say that. Wow, great minds in the same Iron Dumb. That's what it is. Iron Dome.
By the way, it's Golden Dome.
Iron Dumb Dome. Right. Okay. Now, you know, I've been there. I've done that. I was on active duty with the CIA analysis section during Reykjavik. When Gorbachev picked up on something that Reagan had already said, is, let's eliminate all nuclear weapons. What do you think, Mr. President? And Reagan said, oh gosh, that would be so good. Let me talk to my team. He goes to his team. And you know what they tell him? They tell him, Mr. President, that would be the end of your Star Wars. That would be the end of our ability to protect against any missile coming into the United States. This dome we could put up, we didn't call it Dome or Iron Dome. No, it's a dome. It would be just terrific. And we knew that was a charade. You could never build that kind of system. All you'd be doing is giving more funds to the defense industries. And we didn't have a chance to tell Ronnie that. He came back to Gorbachev and said, my team says no. We can't do that. The reason was this Iron Dome concept that you could have an ABM system. Now, what can you have? You can have things lots short of that. Now, what am I talking about? During the negotiations for the anti-ballistic missile treaty signed in May of 1972 in Moscow, I was there. I was part of that, not negotiation, but intelligence setup. We were asked by Kissinger, all right, McGovern, are the Russians going to cheat? Don't know. Probably. Well, how soon can you tell us if they cheat? So I went back to all the people that run the satellites and all that kind of stuff. I said, well, how soon? About a week, 10 days. I go back, week, 10 days. Okay, that's good enough. We'll sign it, all right? Доверяй, но проверяй. Trust, but verify. Did they cheat? Yeah, they cheated. They built this big ass, pardon my French, a big ABM radar in the middle of Krasnoyarsk, in the middle of Siberia. Did we find it? Yeah, we found it. Did we tell the president? Of course we did. The president say, what did he say? Well, go show the Russians those photos and tell them to knock it down. And we did. Now, it took them several years. It was Bush who was finally the president. But Gorbachev came in and said, all right, you guys are right. That was a cheating. We'll knock it down. And they knocked it down. So all I'm saying is here is that these arrangements, given the sophistication of these verification devices, they can be employed. All you need is a modicum of trust. And I believe that it's still possible. I believe that Putin will think back to those days when he pulled Obama's chestnuts out of the fire with respect to making war on Syria, which Obama didn't want to do, okay? Look back to that and say, look, these guys can be a little bit more reasonable, but we have to be aware of the deep state. We have to doverai no proverai.
Let me add to Ray's well-meant remarks, because I endorse them. I mean, we're both Americans, and we would like, and we know Russia rather well, and we want there to be a state of trust. However, given that the sides are at war now, hot war, in a way they weren't in the times Ray was talking about, the urgency of reaching a basis of trust is pressing all of us. Mm-hmm. And let me read you what Dmitry Rogozin has just said in relation to some of this performative PR that's coming from the US side. I mention Rogozin first because his experience is unusually broad, covering the foreign ministry. He was Russia's ambassador to NATO, political. He was the advisor to the presidential candidacy of Alexander Lebed in 1996, who nearly knocked off President Yeltsin at the time. He is a potential presidential candidate for the succession in whenever it comes in Russia, because he's young enough to succeed. And he's now the senator for Zaporozhye, and he runs a combat unit on the front. And Rogozin, for more background, people go to Dances with Bears, the website. But here's what he said about the negotiations to date, not exactly since Jeddah, but in parallel. He said, this is obviously in English, it's going back and forth. Then he's against, meaning Trump is against the war. Then he supplies the modern fascists, meaning Ukrainians, with a means of space communication. He's referring to the intelligence sharing. Here's the punchline. So the fish wants to eat and wants the money to earn more money. I don't understand these paramons. Now, I'm not quite sure, because I'm not an Orthodox Christian, but when he says, I don't understand these paramons, he's using a reference to Russian Orthodox or Orthodox doctrine. Paramons are fast before a feast. It's a celebration of fast, and we're in Lent now. So Christians understand fasting before Easter, the resurrection, and then there's a feast. Okay, so the symbolism here is, I don't understand the fast that comes before the resurrection and then the feast. He's using a Christian doctrine which the Ukrainians have repressed and destroyed. Orthodox Christianity is being destroyed in the Ukraine, and that's one of the cultural and religious issues of some concern on the Russian side that have to be negotiated. What Rogozin means is, if I understand correctly, is that you can't understand what the US side is offering. Is it a fast? Is it a feast? Is it a resurrection? And if so, of what? And as Ray and I both said, we would like to see trust, a resurrection of trust. And that means a fasting, a demolition, a withdrawal, a reduction, mutually verified, of all the arms that can kill each other. But right now, as we approach Easter, Rogozin is saying, I don't know what they're offering. Is it a fast? Is it a feast? What is it? And he's in a position to be speaking very carefully And what he also means is the president of Russia, the general staff, and the diplomatic corps headed by Mr. Lavrov have to solve the problem, answer the question, what are they really offering, and how does it threaten our security?
I agree with that. And I would say that there are two main factors here that the Russians are clearly aware of and take into account. One is the what I call the military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academia, think tank complex. Eisenhower called it the MIC, the military industrial complex. It lives, it's very, very strong. It is, after all, the reason why Reagan could not persuade his team that Gorbachev was right in eliminating all nuclear weapons. It's very, very strong, okay? Now, Iron Dome or Iron Dome, where does that come from? That comes from these cats, okay? Does Trump have to pay attention to that? Yeah, he does. Everybody does. And not only that. Number two, Vladimir Putin himself has talked about dealing with many, many presidents, okay? And when they come in, it's very interesting until the men with the little attaché cases and the dark glasses and the nice suits, just like I'm wearing, says Vladimir Putin, come in and tell the president who's really in charge, okay? In the old days, we would say, oh, that's Soviet propaganda. But I've been around long enough here to realize that that's a real deal. And that's something that these guys have to be really afraid of. Now, Trump has not shown himself fully in control now. He's put Tulsi Gabbard in as director of national intelligence. That is very good. And that accounts for some of the most sensible steps taken with respect to Ukraine, not with respect to Gaza. Okay. So that's one. Now he has Kash Patel, head of the FBI, the epitome of the deep state and the guys with the attaché cases and the dark glasses, okay? He has not been able, that is, Kash Patel, the newly minted head of the FBI, has not been able to order his troops to cooperate with court orders to produce documents embarrassing to the Obama administration and the Biden administration, embarrassing to everybody. Court orders disregarded, even though Kash Patel now has the titular power to say, you will comply finally. This is 6-7 years old. You will comply with that court order. Hadn't done that yet. So all I'm saying is that the Russians are watching this just as closely as John and I are, okay? And they say, okay, who's in charge of Washington? We don't know. What good is a Trump promise? We have to doverai, no proverai.
Yeah. I think we can wrap it up right now. Thank you so much, John and Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure to talk with
Thank you. Thank you, Neiman. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Ray.
See you soon, both.
I hope Bye-bye. So.
Take care.